The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And I'm here at Dim Wine Company, or maybe just Wine Co., because it's just CO, with the owner. It is Peter Dim. Peter, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me.
I'd love to hear a little bit about the history, because you guys, you've only been making wine for a relatively short amount of time in comparison to some of your neighbors, but wine in your family and grape growing has been around for ages, hasn't it?
Yeah, we've been on this farm for almost my entire life here in Jordan. But my dad's, you know, he grew up, both my parents actually, they grew up on vineyards back in Slovenia in the old country, which is why we have them here, right? So when my dad retired from the army back in the 50s, I guess, he meant to go take over his family's vineyards, but my grandfather said no. He was only 25, so I guess I get it. So he left for Germany for 2 years and then decided to come to Canada following his older brother. And after a couple of years of saving money, they bought our first vineyard just down the road. So it was a 40-acre plot, and 10 years after that, we bought this one over here. So total, we've got about 30 acres.
When did your father, just give the time period here, when did he start planting grapes? When did he realize that this area would work well for that industry?
Well, they spent a couple of years saving money, and they got to know the countryside because they have cousins who own, at the time, it was orchards over in Beansville. So being a man of the land, as they all are over in Slovenia, he knew that the climate here was the same as back home. You know, this whole area was 30,000 acres of juice grapes, of Labruscas. To him, he's like, where's all the wine grapes? So when we bought our first vineyard, right away, we bought it in the spring of 73. They finished that harvest. The following spring, my dad planted his first acre of Gamay Nouveau. And it was only Gamay because it was the only variety he can get his hands on. He didn't know where to go at the time. Following that, a year later, he planted an acre of Riesling and an acre of Chardonnay. And then every year he planted something. So by the 90s, we were fully replanted.
I mean, that's kind of a visionary, because if it's the mid-70s, I mean, there was a couple places that were doing it, but there
just a handful of farmers were planting. The oldest might have been Daniel Enkel's grandfather, the Mary Nessens. You know, that's about it. It was barely a handful of people. You know, Cave Spring came in 76. So, yeah, my dad was a handful of farmers who knew that they would do well here, right? It's the same climate. You know, the biggest difference between where he grew up in Slovenia and here is, you know, we get the odd killer winter here. And with global warming, that might change. But we'll see. But, you know, there's a lot of things that we can do to mitigate that. Some of the newer things right now would include blanketing your vineyard under a geotextile, which will save it. And the bonus thing about using geotextile is you get a bit of a head start in the spring. Right? They act like a greenhouse. So you can get 2 weeks early bud break.
Then totally off topic, and then we're going to get back to the mid-70s. How was your reaction a couple of years ago when you saw what was going on in Okanagan and just the deep freezes there that just destroyed so many vineyards for several years? I imagine there's a lot of winemakers that maybe never, well, the smaller ones will never be able to recover.
No, I hear that one in four wineries are now for sale over there. I don't know if that's true. It's just the rumor. I haven't looked. But yeah, but you know what? There's a reason why there weren't vineyards there before. People got comfortable. And the same thing here. You don't just get into the business by buying the next piece of available land. You got to do your research. And if traditionally you haven't had these varieties that aren't winter hardy, you know, you're going to get bit at some point.
So then going back to your dad, there's not just visionary, but it does take some guts, because to buy the land, to buy the grapes, to start growing it, that is a financial investment that you can't 100% guarantee is going to, and excuse this, the pun that I'm about to do. I hate myself for doing it. You didn't know it was going to bear fruit when he originally decided to do it.
So you do what you know, right?
Right.
So he grew up with vineyards. They were, I don't know if you want to call them substantial, but maybe for the area, my grandfather and my great-grandfather were they had acreage over there. So growing grapes is something he grew up with. Going on the commercial side, not so much, like, you know, starting a winery, which is why he never did. But he always made wine. You know, the garage behind me there was where my dad always made wine, and where I started getting into it when, mid-2000s, I started criticizing his winemaking a little too much after I started taking a few night courses on winemaking. And I don't know, it was 2007 or 2008. He said, fine, you do it. And that's how I got into winemaking.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious, because the classic question asks is how you get it. You got into it. Obviously, family, you grew up with it, and now you're taking classes. Now you're critical. What were your main criticisms of your father as a winemaker or some of his finished product?
It was, you know, the obvious. Like, he was letting it oxidize a little too much and using barrels that he should have retired a long time ago. It was simple things like that. And, you know, paying attention to the lab results, which he never did. He always just went off, you know, what he felt was right. And sometimes he made really good wine, and sometimes it went bad. And those times when it went bad, he didn't know why. And that was the problem, right?
So for him, it was all about the gut, about the heart, the emotional side to it, the artist side to it, and ignoring sort of the scientific side.
Exactly. And that's what the courses at Niagara College taught me when I took the lab courses with Dr. Tom. You know, it just kind of verifies, you know, you go in this direction when you see this result, right? And he was just going, you know, flying off the seat of his pants, right?
So you go to the college. Was there a moment when you realized this is what you want to do, that wine? Because once you start making wine or getting your own winery, that's your life. But was there a moment when you were young where you realized this is what you want to do with your life?
Like every other kid that grew up on a farm, I couldn't wait to get off of it. When I graduated from high school and moved to Toronto for school, studied engineering, and then I went to Western for development. But at some point, I remember sitting in a library at Western University in my favorite spot that overlooked the old buildings of the university. And I remember looking across the street thinking, that would make a really cool winery. It was one of those old Gothic buildings, right?
Yeah.
And that's when I realized, okay, I might be heading back to Jordan at some point in my life. Mind you, I was early 20s, and it didn't happen until I hit 42-ish when my dad passed away. Before he passed away, he called me over and said, hey, the doctors only gave me 6 months to live. What do you want to do with the farm? And I said, there's only one thing I want to do with the farm, start a winery. And he said, well, I won't be able to stop you. In about 6 months, he ended up living for another year and a half, which was cool because my kids got to know him a little better. And then when he passed, you know, we moved back in and started with our first vintage, 2015 Riesling. And every year we added a few extra wines, and here we are.
What are your main memories of that 2015?
Probably not good memories, and not wine related, but business related. I did start this with a business partner, and before that first wine was even bottled, we already started fighting about money. And then even years after that, you know, this is not a business to go into on a budget, and it's not to go into half-assed, right? Your time frames are extremely long. If I was making widgets, I'd buy the raw material, make the product, and sell it. With wine, grow the raw material, which is a battle on its own if Mother Nature is not on your side. And then you make the wine, and then you wait, and you wait. And then you start all over again before the first wine's even ready to sell. And then you do it a second time, a third time, and a fourth time. And then you sell your first product. The timelines for winemaking and wine selling are extremely difficult. High anxiety if you're not prepared for it, and very expensive.
It's something that doesn't get talked about a lot is those first couple of years, also raising the money and being able to be comfortable knowing all the money's going out and nothing's coming in.
If you're the accountant at a winery, you've got a very stressful job. There's no other way to do it. And the way I saw it was, we're not millionaires. We're just middle-class people that I grew up on this property. I know what it can produce. And I think I would have hated myself for the rest of my life if I didn't just take the chance. I couldn't bear selling it without trying. So, you know, we've 45 years of selling the grapes to all the other winemakers in Niagara. They've always come back and said, that's the property. I remember when I was 12, 13 years old, I was coming around the winery here, heading back to the house, and Paul Bosk was screaming at my dad about something in the driveway. And it froze for a second. I thought, what's going on there? I didn't know who it was. And then after he left, I went up to my dad and said, what's that all about? And he goes, I don't know. He's just pissed off at me. I'm not selling my Chardonnay to him. A short time after that, my dad and I ran into his son, Stefan. And my dad goes, why is your dad mad at me? And Stefan turns to my dad and he goes, you know, Ivan, my dad can get Chardonnay from anyone, but he wants yours. He proceeded to tell my dad why, but I was a kid. I didn't really pay attention, so I kind of missed out. I don't remember what the answer was, but I have a feeling it was something along the lines of what everyone else says. There's something about this little location. It's not just my property. I'm sure it's the property around me, the fields around me. But the pH is always perfect. The sugar's good. The acid is where you want it to be. There's something about the soil here, the microclimate. You know, dare I say the word terroir. You don't want to sound pompous, but it's the only way to explain this location. Something good about it. There's something perfect about it. Not every year, you know, we have years where we struggle, but when the wine is made 90% of the time, it's a fantastic wine.
I think the pompous is if you're not from France and you say terroir, but you put a French accent, I think then it's pompous. When you go to the terroir, you know, then you can be labeled pompous. Otherwise, it's just a good catch-all to explain why the Pinot Noir or the Chardonnay, the Merlot here, is different than, say, at St. David's. Actually, you know what we should do? I haven't even done it yet. Explain to the people listening, where are your grapes sourced from? What is the sub-appellation? Where are we right now?
We are in Creek Shores. And it's exactly that, creek and shores. We are bounded by Lake Ontario in the north, the shoreline of Lake Ontario in the north. To the south, it's the old shoreline of Lake Iroquois, because we are standing on the old lake bed when Lake Ontario used to be 30% larger. On the west side is Jordan Harbor, so creek. And on the east side, I guess it would be the 12. So we're bounded by water courses. Hence, Creek Shores. We're geographically big, but we don't have a lot of vineyards in this spot. And I think the majority of the vineyards are either close to the lake or close to the edge of the benchlands. Because as soon as you go south, you hit Jordan Bench or 20 Bench. What makes us special? I think, you know, we are located right on the edge of the bench. We're 4 kilometers from the lake. We've got a little bit of north aspect. But there are parts of my Cabernet spots that have some south-facing slopes, which is kind of nice. But we are mostly north because we're the old lake bed draining north to the Lake Ontario. What makes this little area special to me is all the little ravines, or large ravines, that are eroded into the benchlands just south of where we're standing right now. Between Jordan Village and the next main valley, the 16-18 mile creek, which we kind of call Big Valley because there's a campground there, the number of eroded valleys in this stretch, so let's just say it's 2-3 kilometers long, is the highest number of valleys eroded along the whole benchland. If you go west of Jordan, you hardly see them. If you go east of Big Valley into St. Catharines, you hardly see them. The benchlands kind of level out a little bit. But where'd that soil go, though? All that soil eroded right below our feet. And one of the things about the greatest vineyards in the world sit on stratified soil. Different kinds of soil and different eons, like California would be some volcanic soils. Bordeaux, obviously limestone sediments. Burgundy, same thing. You know, Burgundy might have older soils. What makes us special is how young our soils are, but stratified. And I know we've got a deep water table where we are, which is beneficial to a vineyard. Grapes hate sitting in wet soil. We've got a spring well dug over by the production building. It goes down about 27 feet. By August, September, October, it'll be down 20 feet, the water level. So I know our grapes are looking for that water when they really need it, which forces them to dig down deep, deep, deep. And every layer of soil that those roots pass through is a flavor in the wine.
That's a great way to put it.
I think that's what makes us special.
And it's funny, this little area, though, is very good for Riesling, because you guys are here, and I tried both your Rieslings. I think I'm probably a little more the minority. I like the off-dry one. I love both of them, but I always have a taste for a little bit of the off-dry. And then your one-minute drive or three-minute drive from here, Sue Ann Staff and Flat Rock, and both of them also do some very good Rieslings mm-hmm. as well.
Yep. They're a little higher up elevation-wise, so a little cooler. So nice long growing season for them. They are literally planted on that limestone escarpment, where we don't really have any limestone stones in our vineyard, but we have plenty of continental glacier rubble. There's actually I call it the gravel pit, smack dab in the middle of our vineyard. If you walk through it, it's just stone. It almost looks like, you know, it looks like something from Burgundy, where it's just a mix of stone. Before my dad planted that spot, he had a bulldozer come in and level it a little bit and exposed even more stone. I remember spending weekends when we were kids picking up all the stone and moving it off the vineyard, you know, backbreaking work. I'm actually thinking about moving the stone back. One thing really nice about having a Cabernet vineyard in stone like that is, you know, the sun heats up the stone and the soil, and then as the sun sets, the stones radiate the heat back into the vineyard. So I think I'm going to have to break my back and put the stone back.
That's what you have kids for, you know.
That's what I got girls, though.
You know. So what are we drinking? What are we drinking here, by the way?
So this is the newest release of Cabernet Sauvignon, 2019 vintage. The labels are coming. It's just your typical for what I think a Cabernet should taste like in Niagara. We do a Passamento here, so I think that's our little secret. Maybe not secret, but that's, I think, our future, if I have to say it any other way. There's one thing about Niagara that we have that, say, Bordeaux doesn't have, and that's a cooler September. A perfect year like last year or even 2020 is where we got heat all the way through. But a lot of years, what we get is early September where the temperatures just drop off. So sugar production gets delayed a little bit. Acid stays a little high. Because of that, if we don't have a long fall, we need to do something extra. And that extra would be drying the grapes. So we've got tobacco kilns that we put the grapes in, turn on the blowers. Last year, we left them in there for about a month, and it changed bricks by about 2.5. From 23 bricks to about 25.7. It's just one of the things we do in our little toolbox of winemaking that will tweak our product to the point where it's acceptable or even better than what you'd get anywhere else.
Well, you need to do it also. There's nothing worse than underripe Cabernet Sauvignon. That it's green, it's bell pepper, it's stocky, and it's at least for me, and I think for a lot of people, it's just not a pleasant drinking experience.
No, and you know, when you're trying to get a decent price point on it, that's not expected, right? You know, you want to get rid of those cedar notes. The best thing to do is to have a ripe grape that's balanced. Mm-hmm. And the best way for us to do that is to dry them.
What's the difference in terms of time and energy when you use that Passamento for your Cabernet for, say, you know, your most recent vintage versus, say, 2020? Is it the same amount of time or is it less time depending on just how much heat you got?
Yeah, no. So every year's different, right? So, you know, I remember one year we picked in early December, but it was a good fall. So the grapes hung on to the vine very well. The leaves were on until the very end, where last year we had an early winter. You know, we're in Canada and the majority of the world's greatest vineyards sit on the west coast of their continent. Usually the east coast is cooler. We get more fluctuations in temperature, hence the cooler growing season. But there's something special about Niagara, where we've got this massive lake that moderates us. So not only does it extend our growing season so we can ripen these varieties, it kind of mellows out the highs and the lows from year to year. So when you ask me if there's a difference between when we started and now, I think the biggest difference is my knowledge of how to make wine and also the people around us. So, you know, everyone's working together to make better wines. Every wine region starts off as an amateur wine region. It takes one group of people to start a winery and go from amateur to professional. And then when the wines start showing, you know, on award shows, then you start getting interest in investors. And that's exactly how Niagara grew up. Right now we've got award-winning winemakers, right? We've got winemakers who are recognized internationally based on the products that's coming out of this little region of ours. You know, we are small, so it's going to take a lot of marketing to get us recognized worldwide. It's happening, you know, slowly because we're so small. But, you know, some of the award-winning wines coming out of Niagara are phenomenal.
Yeah, what you just have to hope for, because of the conservative nature of wine buyers, of restaurants, and also sometimes the somms at restaurants all over the world, they maybe don't want to put in the effort to learn the story of it. But when you get the international acclaim, when you get Decanter, especially when you leave North America and or Wine Spectator for the States, I mean, that's a huge part of it, because it just creates legitimacy. And then it forces these restaurants to go, okay, this Cab Franc is excellent and is going to be much cheaper than that Loire one, which is coming in at twice the price. And then it's up to the storytellers to do their job to tell your story.
Exactly. And, you know, the biggest thing that holds us back is the fact that restaurateurs are, they're adverse to risk. They have enough of the risk to deal with on their own business. But to take a chance on a winery that nobody knows about, they'll do it if the price point is right. We are in Niagara, labor costs are high, expenses are high. So it's, you know, if you don't have that volume to spread out the cost, a small winery like myself, our prices are a little higher, you know, premium priced, but the product is premium. To get them to take a chance on me is the challenge.
And then also the hard part is, it's going to be more difficult to get your wines because of the price. Wine by the glass programs, you know, maybe your Riesling, but that's going to be a hard thing as well, which also is a way to sell and move bottles and also just give awareness if wines are on the by the glass programs.
I find the Riesling glass by the glass is an easy sell, especially mm-hmm. when the wine's good. The harder sell is obviously the red wines that are, you know, the cost a little bit more to make, so a little higher priced. But the response is fantastic. Like, you know, I put one wine in the LCBO at the very beginning and we got no response, even though the label had a map showing where we are and it was a good wine, but no response from consumers from the LCBO. Put that same wine in restaurants and oh my God, you know, phone call, emails, everything. So restaurants are our best friend, not so much the LCBO, but you know, it takes time. It takes time to create a brand. It takes time to market the brand to the point of recognition. And, you know, things like this, individuals like yourself who push us and market us and help, you know, this is what it takes. It takes a family.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Then if I see your wines at a restaurant, I order them. If I see them at the LCBO, same kind of thing. And yeah. To me, I was like, I've said this 100 times, so I'll say it really quick. I push the wines from here, not out of patriotism, not out of the passport, but palate. Because it's really good. And also, I never get bothered by the price because there is more of a fair wage. Because it's not, it's not cheap. You're not giant fields with huge, you know, tractors that are accumulating every grape and then you just throw them all into a giant vat. That's not how your wines are made. It would be impossible for you to charge 25% less for all these wines.
Absolutely. You know, we do have a grape harvester. It's been collecting dust for the last 8 years, ever since we started making higher quality wine. I got to do something with it. Sell it off or something. Yeah, everything's handpicked. The way I farm is, if you compare my farm to my neighbor's farm, it looks very pretty. Mine might look a little rougher, but that's by design. I like to stress my vines out. There's that saying, I don't know if I made it up or I heard it someplace, fine wine is made by a stressed vine. A lazy vine produces a lousy wine. I like to grow cover crop in my vineyards. I only cultivate once every 5 years. What I like to do is let my grass grow. Right now, we've got a very wet May and April.
Yeah.
So with longer grass, the water gets sucked out of the soil faster. So by doing that, there's no soil at the surface to appease my grapevines. Grapevines have 3 root zones, upper, middle, and lower. The middle doesn't do much no matter what, but I don't want the uppers to grow, and the upper would grow if there's lots of moisture at the surface. So cultivating will hold that moisture in there. I want the lower roots to grow because they're the ones that grow vertically down. The top ones grow horizontally. I don't want that because if you do have a dry summer, then there's no moisture at all to produce the grapes. I want deep roots. They'll look for the water when our water table, I know it drops, and that forces the roots to pass through all those layers of soil, and you get all those flavors in the wine.
I totally forgot that's one of the things about the grass and the cover crop is that takes the water out, so then you don't just have a pool of water near the top, and so then the vines don't have to do any work.
Yeah.
Nice. See, when I stopped doing WSET after my diploma many years ago, every year I start to forget things. Let's talk a little bit about your wine program, about the inventory here, I would say the gross oversimplification is you are a Bordeaux blend, Bordeaux Riesling house. That would be a, just if I was going to do it in one sentence, that's what it would be, I would say.
So we've gotten...
you got Pinot Gris as well, for Christ's sake. Sorry.
We've got nine varieties. Mm-hmm. The Pinot Gris is a
Riesling. And Gewürztraminer. Sorry to interrupt. I bought a bottle of the Gewürztraminer. I'm an idiot. All right. You talk about your wine. I shouldn't be doing it.
So there's nine varieties on the farm. There's, what, 13 wines behind me, because some of them are blends. I think we do really well with the Bordeaux reds, which is why we have the majority of those. For whites, we got Riesling, Chardonnay, Gewürz, and Pinot Gris, which all do well. I love the wines from them. For the reds, we've got the two cabs, Merlot and Pinot Noir, which I'm planning on planting next spring, Shiraz and Petit Verdot, and also Malbec, to kind of round out the red blends. I think that does really well on this soil and this aspect. All the response that we've always had from selling these varieties to other winemakers have always been positive, so that's the direction we're going in. I love the whites, but I think the actual bench, they could do those whites really well themselves, so that's the direction we're going in. All my labels are a story, or memory, something that happened to us on the farm. That started by accident with the Chardonnay, just on a discussion I had with this marketing guy I was working with, Simon, and from there it just snowballed.
Well, let's start with the Great Escape Chardonnay, the label that tells the story of a very young, lazy man.
So that's the one that started it all. Simon showed up one day and he goes, I want to run something by you. And I was like, what's that? And he goes, we're trying to figure out what to do with, what direction to go in with the labels. And he pulled out this very rough draft of this picture of my mother when in her 20s. Because back at that point, we planted the Chardonnay vines in 1976. I was 4 years old. And I had this memory, and I checked before my dad passed away. I checked with him. I go, did this really happen? He goes, yeah, something like that. I had this memory of being 4 years old, helping my parents plant these vines. My job was just to hold the vine. My mom was burying the roots, and my dad was up ahead digging the holes. And I don't know how long I lasted. I was four. But I remember thinking, I don't want to be here. So when my mom wasn't looking, I turned and bolted. And my memory was running away from her as fast as my little legs could. And I can hear my mom in the distance screaming at me, come back here, we're not done. And as I was running up the row, my brothers were coming down with more grapevines. So even more motivation to get out of there. We ended up calling the wine the Great Escape Chardonnay.
And what about the McCormick? And that's a great story, by the way. It's perfect. The McCormick Pinot Noir involves a tractor.
Add 12 months to this life of mine. I'm now 5 years old, and I'm now had this memory of driving our first tractor that my dad bought when he bought the farm. It was an old 1960s McCormick International. And my memory was driving down the grape row with it, coming to the end of the row, looking back to see where my dad was, and he was on the trailer with my mom shoveling manure onto those young Chardonnay vines. Because this is long before we had all the correct equipment to run this farm. We didn't have one of those mechanical manure spreaders, so we had to do it all by hand. So my memory was getting to the end of the row, seeing that he's still on the trailer, and he had told me, when you get to the end, pull the choke, kill the engine, because I was too small to turn it. There was no power steering on these old tractors, and I was way too small to stop it. There was no way I could push down on the clutch. So I just pulled the choke and killed the engine. And then my dad jumped on, turned us around, sent me back up the next row. So again, I was like, did this really happen? He's like, yeah. I needed you to drive because when there was no one else.
Yeah, different child labor laws when you're at a farm. It's just you guys trying to get all the grapes.
In the mid-1970s.
Yeah. When you look at these wines and you look at these labels, it must be nice, this sort of sense of ownership, this family history every time you look at a bottle.
You know, it's such a slow evolution doing this because the timelines are so long. It just feels natural. Like, at one point maybe I'll sit back and think, oh, look what we've done so far. But I haven't hit my goals yet, mm-hmm. Right? There's so much more to do. There's so much more that can come off this property. And I've got, so many varieties to plant next year. 12 acres I have to replant. Unfortunately, all the vines that my dad purchased in 1992, they came from California with a virus. And we only found out what the virus was a couple of years ago. So all those vines have got pulled out over the last couple of years. And now we're going to replant six varieties in next spring.
What is your goal? 5 years from now, what would be the realistic best case scenario?
Best case scenario, full production off 30 acres would be about 4,500 cases. as long as we're making great wine, that my wife and I can quit our day jobs and just live off of this family business, along with my brothers. So that's the goal. And I could see us getting there. We're only a couple of years away from, you know, from seeing that to fruition. The biggest hurdle was having to replant those varieties that I wasn't expecting. You know, I wrote probably three versions of a business plan before we even started. And as soon as we started, I threw the third one out and started again. There's something weird about this business. No matter how many times you think you've got it down on how you're going to do things, Mother Nature throws a curveball, or you know, something doesn't work out, and you start from scratch. You start all over again.
I think it'd be great if you found your original first business plan and use that for a label for one of the wines. Because to think about whatever your first business plan versus where you are now, that'd be wild.
Yeah. I think I'd probably have a heart attack at how not immature, but how naive I was.
But I imagine that must be that story must be the same for almost everyone that starts off on their own. And they're not like, say, taking over a family vineyard that's been going on for like 300 years. Like, you're not taking over a third growth Bordeaux.
You know, I had a really good conversation. One of the things that made me actually start is coming back from Europe and not touring Bordeaux. We toured Bordeaux and all that, but touring the small vineyards of Slovenia, who started visiting some of the small wineries there. And I thought, you know what, if they can do it here, we can do it in Canada. And I came back and I gave Leonard Panichetti a call at Cave Spring. And I said, hey, I want to start a winery. Can I talk to you? He goes, Peter, come over tomorrow. So we sit down in his boardroom for a couple of hours. And the one thing I remember from him, it was a long conversation, but one of the things I remember from him saying, don't even bother if you don't have the quality. He goes, I know you. You won't have the budget of a millionaire, so screwing up is not your option. He goes, if you don't have the quality, you're always going to be fighting for the next sale. But if you have the quality, then the consumers will seek you out. So he said, make sure if you're going to go down this road, make sure you take the steps that'll ensure that you have a quality product to sell. And I think that's one of the reasons why it took so long to start from. That was like the late 90s, early 2000s. So, you know, we didn't get our first wine made until 2015. And that was one of the things that I wanted to make sure we weren't going to do, come up with something just mediocre. You know, people always, no matter what you're selling, but wine's probably a very good example of this. People always remember your worst wine.
Yeah. No, it's true. There's vineyards that I'm not going to say names. There's vineyards now that I'm sure make good wine. And I remember my first experience with them. I'm like, nope, there's so many other ones I can go to.
Yeah.
It's a good point. Totally off topic. Who's in charge of your Instagram? I was going through it. You had a Magnum PI clip with a reveal of the tractor. I appreciated that. As someone who's 50 years old, a Magnum PI reference, who's in charge of your Instagram?
Unfortunately, that's me.
So that was you that decided to do that.
It's Magnum.
Yeah. Oh, listen, I'm not disagreeing. If we had more time, we could do top five greatest TV show soundtracks, and Magnum PI would definitely be in the top five.
It's all about that Ferrari.
Yeah, it is all about that Ferrari. Do you remember the names of the two dogs?
Oh, God, no.
Zeus and Apollo.
Oh, that's right.
Were the name of Higgins's two dogs. I'll end with this question. Do you remember the tasting notes of your 2015 Riesling?
No. No, I don't.
Do you have any of those bottles left?
15, I do. I've got probably four cases left. I was keeping, you keep them for future flights. Mm-hmm. So we made a 15, and then we made a 17, and then 19, and now 20. And I was going to do a flight this past fall, and we accidentally sold off all the 17s. So that's not going to happen again.
You need a better accountant, or I guess that account, that's in whoever's in charge of inventory.
You know, I was in charge of inventory, and I had them all laid out perfectly in the storage room. And then my brother went in and cleaned things up because I'm pretty messy. But I didn't mark those four boxes, and I have a feeling he put them in with the 17s, and they must have been sold off because they're gone.
Peter, this has been great. This was recommended from 16 Miles Cellar. They said, you got to come over to Dim. I'm like, well, I haven't been there yet. And by the way, anyone listening, I recommend, it's a really nice tasting room you have here. It's, you know, a lot of old wood and comfortable chairs, and it's a very sort of just intimate, nice feel, and just surrounded by your vineyards. Like, this is a really pretty place for people to come and try wine.
Thank you. Yeah, 16's been really good. Michelle there's sending people over all the time, and we do the same. You know, every small winery in the Jordan area, we're always trying to help each other out.
And then both of them are very different. They're classic Pinot Chard house for you guys, you know, a different sort of inventory. So again, I really appreciate the time. Congratulations on the success. I look forward to 5 years from now when you're at 4,500 cases or more. Thanks for doing
Perfect.
It.
Perfect. Thanks for coming.
Thanks everyone for listening to the Mac Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.